Okay, welcome everybody back. Hopefully everyone else will start coming back in now that we're getting started again. I'm going to try and keep things on time today if we can. So next up we have a wonderful case study. Jim Dunlap is here from GCI. That's a telecom provider and cable company in Alaska, and he actually works in Seattle. So he has a very challenging environment and does a lot of travel as a result of that. And he is a mid-market CIO, and I know a lot of you have not implemented ITIL because it is fairly resource-intensive and you just don't have the bandwidth, meaning sort of the staff and resources to be able to do that. But hopefully after you hear Jim talk, you may be able to get a few ideas how you may be able to implement at least certain parts of it as well. We also have a breakout later today on it as well with a different presenter who's going to talk more about version 3 and the way that aligns IT and business more so than just automating some things within the IT function. So to get started, now that we have our questions working again, I just wanted to get a sense of who in the audience is using ITIL and what your implementations look like. So if you could all pick up your little clickers there and vote for if you've implemented parts of it, you haven't implemented any, but you plan to, or you don't have any plans to implement ITIL at this time. ITIL being IT Infrastructure Library. Okay. All right, so about half of you aren't planning to do it right now, but then the other half of you either have done it or are planning to. So, and we have a follow-up question to that, which is, if you are doing it or planning to, how are you going to do it? Are you going to buy books and CD-ROMs and do it yourself? Implement it using consultants? Or using consultants and new software? Or again, you're just not planning to implement it? The answers are, okay, a lot of you are planning to do it yourself. That's very impressive. A few using only consultants and then either a combination or not planning to do it at all. Okay, great. Jim, I hope that helps you as you get started with your presentation. So come on over and we'll get started.
Good morning. The remote, is it on the podium? Great. I thought before we jumped into ITIL that I would maybe do a little entertaining. So I'm not going to sing and dance up here. But can I maybe see a show of hands of how many of you guys have been to Alaska? Wow. Well-traveled group. Okay. So for the half of you that have not been to Alaska, I brought some home movies. So we're going to start off with that. I know the movie was longer than that. Can you guys start it from back there, or? Rewind. Sound was overrated, so. Great. So hopefully those of you that have not been to Alaska now are at least intrigued to come up and see what it's like. I'm going to try and give you a little context as to what our company does before we jump right into ITEL. I think it's important to have that in terms of getting a better feel for why we're doing what we're doing. We're a full-service communication provider for both the consumer and commercial space. For instance, the entire Trans-Alaska pipeline communications are all outsourced to us. But we serve hundreds of thousands of consumer customers at their homes. So if you look at the kinds of services we cover, long distance, cable television, all sorts of voice services, local and long distance. We're a broadband internet service provider. We publish Yellow Pages directories. We're a wireless service provider, so for your mobile phone. And then we also have two undersea fiber cables that connect Alaska to the lower 48 states. So from a billing and back office perspective, really we have something for everyone, which is a real challenge from an IT perspective. We're about 500,000 subscribers. Interesting number because Alaska only has 660,000 people in it. So more than likely, if you live in Alaska, you are a consumer of ours one way or another. And we're about $500 million in revenue. Demographics. Alaska is a pretty unique place. The disposable income in Alaska is considerably higher than it is in the rest of the U.S. Salaries are high. Cost of living is relatively low. You hear in the past, in the days of building the Trans-Alaska Pipeline in the 70s, stories about milk being $4 and $5 a gallon. Those days are long gone. Prices for groceries and housing are very, very similar to any West Coast city in the U.S. What makes Alaska very different is something called the Alaska Permanent Fund. And back in the 60s, when they found oil in Alaska, they decided to set aside a percentage of the profits and to use those profits to continue to fuel the economy. To date, this slide's about 6 months old. It was, at last check, $35 billion fund. And from that fund, they then distribute a percent of the interest out to every man, woman, and child that lives in Alaska. So when you distribute $1 billion into an economy of only 660,000 people on an annual basis, it drives the economy very differently than what we see in the lower 48 states. Also, federal government spending is very, very high in Alaska due to the strategic position of Alaska from a military perspective. And then lastly, just key drivers. Obviously, oil is a big driver. If President Bush ever had his way, we'd be drilling in Anwar, which is the big controversial oil field near Prudhoe Bay in Alaska. Clearly, strategic missile defense is a big part of what drives the economy in Alaska. There's a significant number of missile facilities throughout the state of Alaska. Natural gas pipeline, we're trying to pull that through right now to actually get natural gas out of the North Slope of Alaska down to the lower 48 states. And then tourism is another big driver. Because of this and because of a geographic slide I'm going to show you here in a second, people spend dramatically more money on telecommunications in Alaska than they do elsewhere. If you look at really the size of the state and then look at our per capita numbers, you'll see a pretty dramatic swing from other marketplaces. 33% more spending on telecom than any place else in the U.S. Number one per capita for households with computers. Number two, for homes with broadband internet access. And you go on to really look at the size of Alaska, 1.5 million square kilometers. You know, we have a joke in Alaska. I don't know, is anybody here from Texas? Okay, great. You'll like this one then. The joke in Alaska is that, you know, what does every Texan fear? That Alaska is going to cut itself in half and Texas will be the third largest state. So, anyway, large, last group I spoke with had a whole bunch of Russians, so I put this last bullet item in there just for them, knowing that at this point the company that was in the audience could have bought Alaska for what we bought it for. If you look at a map, you always see Alaska's ideally situated right by Cabo, right? Clearly, you could see by the video earlier that that's not where it's at. In fact, it's situated about 1,500 to 1,700 air miles from Seattle, Washington, a 3-hour and 40-minute flight on a good day. So a little context, and I'm going to give you a little bit of a sense as to what our network looks like. And again, this definitely plays into ITIL. If you look at every red dot on this map, it is where we have facilities. So that means I have an office, I have customers, I have invoices that go into that community, we have facilities that we provide services that I have to activate and provision. Yellow lines are where we have fiber running from the north part of Alaska down through the Pacific Ocean, back down to one of them lands in Seattle, Washington, the other in Portland, Oregon. And then the fiber that runs up and down the Trans-Alaska Pipeline that services the pipeline. So to put that in perspective, and this is the last geographic slide, then we're going to get right into ITIL. I want to show you this quick video. You'll see, again, Alaska. We're going to lay on top of that our network locations, and then we're going to pick Alaska up and move it around, just to give you a sense for the size and scale of the state. These videos don't want to run. Broke it. The Europeans love that one. This is where the Russians were mad because we completely skipped Russia and went right on over to India. The point being that we're dealing with immense geographies here. If our company was located in the lower 48 states or in Europe and covered this sort of geography, we would be one of the largest telecom and cable companies in the world. So we have some unique challenges that I'd like to explain, really. You know, why did we get into ITIL? I've been in this role for about 4.5 years. Replacing a CIO who had been in place for about 8 years. And I guess a few questions. What is ITIL and why does it matter? The thing that I tell people when they ask me is ITIL is the de facto worldwide standard for IT service delivery. Doesn't matter whether you're in the medical industry, whether you're in the telecom industry, whether you're in the financial services industry, the same set of practices, the same set of procedures all fall true, regardless of industry. It provides truly a systematic approach to how you handle day-to-day service delivery. And we're going to go through, you know, what does that mean, and what does it look like to start from scratch, and then how do you get to the point to where we're at today, and lots of others as well. You know, what's the promise for ITIL? Well, it's really this. It's that as you move up the curve, that you see greater and greater value, that as you implement more of the processes, more of the procedures, and it becomes a culturally ingrained part of what you do, that you see greater and greater value as you move from truly a firefighting reactive mode to eventually a very process-driven service delivery mode. What are the key processes? There are really two sets. There's service delivery processes and service support processes. I'm going to take you through some examples of each of these and then talk about sort of the pluses and minuses of them. On the service delivery process side, it is service level management, IT financial management, which is radically different than IT than financial management at other parts of the business. And we'll talk a little bit about why that's the case. Capacity management, IT service continuity management, and then availability management, all key service delivery processes. And then there's a set of service support processes. Those start out with the service desk, which in an ITIL model is really at the heart and soul of everything you do. It begins with the service desk and it ends with the service desk. Incident management, problem management, change management, release management, and then configuration management. And again, we'll define each of these as we go along. This maps those processes back to particular organizations. So as I look at the key parts of my organization, whether it's the service desk, application management, development and integration, operations, or IT systems, I can map these processes across very specifically to each organization. Here's a brief definition. I won't go through every one, but I think service level management is pretty self-explanatory. And you'll see in a couple of slides where we went in and did an analysis of our own capabilities back in 2004 that really we had no service level management. I could go to our CEO and ask him if he had a concept of what IT was here to deliver. He had no concept, no expectations, good or bad, which was a real detriment for us in terms of where we needed the organization to go to support the business. Availability management, knowing literally the availability of your systems. Are you a 24/7 by 365 operation? We are. Our customer service reps are on the phone, need billing systems available. They need activation and provisioning and inventory systems available, 24/7, websites available 24/7. But knowing whether or not that is a business requirement and then how to manage it. Change management. I don't know about you guys, but whenever I walked in the door, there was not a shred of evidence that we knew anything about change, other than we would make it whenever we wanted, however we wanted, with no rhyme or reason. So change management is something that is probably one of the most crucial processes that I would point out. It is the one area that we gained, I think, the most in terms of true stability in the IT environment and the ability to then begin systematically implementing better and more rigid and more process-driven structure. Incident management. It's basically how you restore services and how quickly you can make that happen with minimal disruption out to the end users. Problem management is both reactive and proactive. It's really geared towards how you resolve problems as rapidly as possible. What are the processes that you use to do that? And also, what tools do you have in place to identify problems before they become an issue? An example I can give you is in our data centers. In the old days, 4 years ago, we would have occasionally a thermal event. Everybody here knows what a thermal event is. It's whenever the air conditioning load doesn't keep up with the heat that's being produced by the servers. We would have one of those probably maybe once every 6 months. And everybody knows what happens after a thermal event. It's a matter of weeks before you begin to see hardware failures. You never know what's going to fail, but you can be guaranteed something is going to fail. So our mode in that day in terms of problem management was very reactive. We waited for something to fail and then dealt with that failure. Today, in our data center, we have infrared cameras that basically are watching all the equipment for us. And if we see a change in the temperature of that equipment, we know that we need to take some sort of proactive maintenance so that we don't have a reactive problem situation in place. Service desk. I can't say enough about the service desk. It really is the heart and soul of an ITIL management model. And I think many of us, myself included, came from a traditional help desk model where literally there was a small set of applications that people called about. It was to get your, get your user logons straightened out. It was to fix your printer configuration. It was to do those kinds of things. Well, in an ITIL model, a service desk is really, it is the heart and soul of the entire operating model. It's where all incoming calls come to so that you can track performance. It is sort of the triage mechanism where things go to second and third level support. It's also the location that takes on an awful lot of training and sort of broader facilitation of information sharing about IT and the services that you offer. Release management. How do you put things into production? Do you just slam them into production? Is there a systemic process that you can go through to actually put things very deliberately into a production model that is repeatable and that gives you the outcome that you were looking for? We went from a day in the day of actually backing out an awful lot of releases we put into production before 2004, 2005. Now, I can't tell you the last time that we took something out of production that we put in. Configuration management, basically how do you account for all of your assets, whether it's systems, whether it is hardware, and then how do you use that information to really provide as much support as possible to the other ITIL processes. Again, a slightly different matrix, but it really shows you how those processes, again, map up to different parts of the organization. Here was our scorecard in 2004. This is true confessions time for you. I was here for a couple of years before this happened, so I take responsibility for where we were in a number of these. I won't go through them all. I'll point out a couple that I think are pretty critical. The first one is pretty much a stake in the heart, I think, for most of us in the room. If you're not in the business of being an enabler for the business, you probably have no business being in IT. Because, frankly, that is our reason for being. None of us are in IT companies. So that was, I think, our biggest driver. Were we an enabler, or were we the throttle for how the business was growing? As I looked at our organization, we were very unclear about roles and responsibilities. If I'd asked people in 2004, what's your job, three-quarters of them would have raised their hands and said, I'm a developer. They weren't, but they all thought they were. As we look at processes, they were very ad hoc. I couldn't find a repeatable, documented process for anything in the IT organization. And then no standards. We didn't have an SDLC, a software development lifecycle process. We didn't have any standard testing and QA tools. And then really there was inconsistent or incomplete or not existent at all reporting and management review of what was being done. I won't go through all these, but just you can read through them. The slides are in your packet. Was not a good situation. Frankly, we were in a very reactive mode. We're an IT organization of roughly 130 people with a budget in the $30 million range. So sizable IT organization supporting 1,300 employees and $500 million in revenue with basically no real infrastructure or process by which to do that. So you look at these things and you see things like longer problem response time. Our outages weren't being tracked, first off, so we had to start tracking them to figure out what an outage looked like and to figure out how we improved the resolution time to that. No real service levels, no real service standards. Lots of inefficiency. You know, with 130 people, I know I've talked to a number of you here over the last couple of days, have staffs considerably smaller than that. So you can imagine what you should be able to do with 130 people, which is the expectation I came in with. We had lots of gaps between lack of communication within the organization itself, not knowing when they hand something off to the service desk, what then goes to the tier two organization, what goes to infrastructure, what has to come back to the service desk for communication perspective. Instability in the application environments, and then just general discontent. You know, I'd have to say, looking back to 2004, IT was not a popular part of the company. Lots of risks of not moving forward. These will all be known to you guys. But as the pace of business changes, and I think all of us can identify with this, business is not slowing down. Business is speeding up very, very consistently. And so the ability to not just keep pace with that, but to be slightly ahead of the curve is a crucial part of what we do. And you can't do it without processes to support the day-to-day environment that you have today. So more risks of not moving forward. And then what do we do about it? Here are the processes we tackled, and again, service level management, incident management, the service desk, building out a real service desk, change management, problem management, release, configuration, availability, application management, something brand new to us. There is a standardized way to manage vendor-supported applications. That was new news. We had no idea. We thought everyone was a one-off. And then having a software development lifecycle. These slides I really truly won't go through other than to point out if you'd like to take a look at these, you can see what were the key things about software development lifecycle, what were the benefits, short and long-term attributes of them, and then what were the risks of us not doing these things. For software development lifecycle, it was pretty substantial. It meant we were putting crappy software into production. Change and release. It's amazing how quickly you can institutionalize something like change management. We now have had it in place for three and a half years. Today, everybody in the organization knows what it is. We talk about it regularly. It's a very formal process that we've molded over the years to become more business savvy, more business friendly. And it's a standard part of what we do. It's a standard part of the culture now. Service level management. I said earlier, we had none. Management had no idea whether we were performing well. They didn't. Were not able to track any of our outages or resolution time or availability at all. And so we put a very, very rigorous set of processes, reports, communications, marketing tools out to the business. I didn't include it in this slide deck. I'd be glad to send it to you. My email address is at the end of this deck. But I have a whole slide deck on our monthly, quarterly, and annual service level management targets. We report those out to the whole company, every customer service rep, every manager, every VP, and then out to the board of directors once a year to really reset what our targets should be. Job scheduling and monitoring tools. There's an awful lot of complexity in today's IT environment. It's gone so complex that you really can't monitor things and manage them without some set of automated tools to help you do so. So we took that in as a key part of our ITIL initiative to put the right monitoring and management tools in place. Again, application management. I spoke briefly about this one, but there is a defined process for how you manage vendor-supported applications. There's also a defined process for how you manage in-house developed applications. So in both of those, I think our risk was very substantial in that we were managing every application slightly differently. Today, we manage every vendor relationship, and every application in an identical manner with an identical process. So if I would like a scorecard on all of our vendors and their performance and the applications and their performance, it has relative meaning to me across each application. Incident and problem management, pretty straightforward. Program management, a critical part of what we had to put in place. We did not have a program management office, a PMO. We have had a standard staffed PMO. We have two full-time staff members in there and flex that group up and down depending on project volume. This year, I've got 10 people in the PMO, heading up one person as the manager of the PMO. And we report in on a weekly basis every project in a standard format, standard set of risk analysis, standard set of financial analysis tools, and really allows me to roll up our entire portfolio of projects on a real-time basis once a week and report that out to my peers and to my boss. People, process, and technology. Organizational change management. You can't do ITIL without tackling the cultural side of this. It's all about people. You can put processes in place, you can put tools in place, but unless you have the staff coming along with you on that journey, you're not going to get there. So I guess a word of advice is tackle organizational change management. We didn't use that word. We used the word people, process, and technology. It sounded friendlier. And we continue years down the road to go through solid organizational change management on an annual basis. I lay out a change management plan for the year of what we're going to do to continue to change the culture of how we do business for the company. Results, it's been good. It's had its ups and downs. I'll tell you that up front. It's not easy to implement ITIL. It's not easy to have an organization go from no process to very process-driven. That's a huge cultural shift. But it's had some very substantial impact on our company. It truly has enabled us to become the group that enables growth of the business. We now are no longer the throttle. We are very much, like I heard from others here today, are the people pulling the business along. I spend a lot of time actually throttling my staff, keeping them from pulling the business too far too fast. So it's enabled us to get into a very, very different model for how we execute the work on behalf of the company. We certainly have used our service desk to provide a central communication point for what goes on within IT, whether it's you requesting a service or whether it's getting information out to you about a service or an incident that has occurred related to you. We've decreased our total cost of ownership. I spoke of what 130 people should be able to do. Well, now managing our operating environment, we have 45 to 50 people on a full-time basis. The rest of the staff works on projects, capital projects, making improvements within that infrastructure, deploying new systems into the infrastructure, or out seated into the business as business consultants working on the IT infrastructure for very particular parts of the business. It's changed the way we manage availability. It certainly has changed our development process. Having a software development process is critical for a number of reasons. One, you put better code into production, but two, as a public company, you have the right IT general controls to be able to check the box for your SOX certification. It has allowed us to really retrain our staff, gear them towards an ITIL process-driven IT infrastructure model. So we've now taken people who, again, raised their hand saying they were a developer and said, no, we're going to actually go back and train you on problem and incident management, and we're going to invest in that training and ask you to invest in it as well. So it's changed the makeup of our staff. There's definitely an ITIL staffing model that you can follow that talks about roles and responsibilities, and we've done just that. I think it's enhanced our ability to create new offerings for the company. Back in 2004, 2005, to put a new long-distance or local or wireless phone plan in place, it took us anywhere from a month to 4 months, depending on the complexity of it. It was random coding processes, random implementation processes. We'd have to put it in and back it out a few times before it worked right. Now we implement new plans in a matter of hours. It's a routine that marketing will say, we've heard this, our competitor is doing this in the market tomorrow, and we want to run a new ad beginning tomorrow morning. And we're going to run radio at 6 a.m. So when can you have the plan in place and able to take new orders? And then I think in general, it's just increased the satisfaction levels across the board from senior level executives, I think the board of directors, and then down in the line staff. I think they understand that business is here, or that IT is here to help the business succeed. I've got 10 things to tell you as a summary. You have to sell ITIL. And we have an entire marketing strategy around our IT organization, not just ITIL, but around how you market the IT organization. It's a critical part of the business. You market it no differently than you would if it was another standalone for-profit business line. Let's see here. There's my 10 key lessons. Learn continuously about ITIL and about best practices. There are more than enough courses on ITIL in the industry today for you to pick one up just about anywhere. We used a company called Pink Elephant. I don't know if you've ever heard of them. It's kind of a funny-sounding name, but probably one of the better ITIL training organizations. We brought them both in-house and sent people out to their courses. Implement process ownership, responsibility, authority, and accountability. For all of our staff members, part of their performance evaluations on an annual basis, bring these factors directly to bear. So all the way down to the entry-level person who's sitting at the service desk, they understand very clearly what their ownership of the process is, if they have one. They understand what their responsibility is in that process, what authority they have within it, and then what accountability they have. And again, we carry those through right back out to evaluations. Know what the business objectives are and make sure they're being clearly measured. We developed an entire staff of business consultants, 10 individuals whose job it is to assure that we're aligned with where the business is going on a real-time basis. They help us with how we manage everything from scope definition to how we manage prioritization of what we do. And again, they're seated in with the business. They live with the business day to day. And I would say I've given them very much a dual reporting relationship where they both report to me and to the vice president of whatever line of business they happen to be working with. Make sure your metrics are related to business metrics. Somebody said this earlier. Our company does not speak IT at all. We're a technology company. We still don't speak IT. So I have to relate every metric back to something in the business. Making sure that metrics are measured, collected, and reported. And again, I can send you our entire slide deck on that. It takes place on a monthly basis, quarterly, and annually. My compensation is heavily tied back to those metrics. And I tie the compensation of all of my direct reports back to those as well. Sell the concept inside and out. Be ready to implement it whenever you get an opportunity. We used projects as an opportunity to implement additional ITIL processes. A large billing conversion was the first time we put software development lifecycle processes in place, that we put a true incident management or change management process in place. So we look for those opportunities to use ITIL and implement an ITIL process on the backbone of some other project, as opposed to ITIL being a standalone initiative. Be patient. I started this journey in 2004. Here we sit in 2007, and we're still on it. And then know that IT service management is really, it's the definition and execution of a process. It's not a team, it's not a culture, it's not a tool. ITIL gives you the framework within which to implement. And really, it's back to you and your team in terms of how it gets executed and implemented for the benefit of the business. With that, I think I have time for any questions, if there are any. Yes. Absolutely. I can tell you, I would do it in an IT organization of 10 people or less. Yeah. I know that didn't help Brad because he and I were talking earlier and he's got less than that. But it's, I would do it in an organization of 10 or less. I think there are processes you can pick out of ITIL that are applicable to any size of organization. But to look at the broad breadth of them, really you have to have a clear division of roles and responsibilities. Even if that's one person owns IT infrastructure and another owns service desk, another owns change management, or the group owns change management across the board, as we do in our company. But I think you have to have that delineation of roles and responsibilities. And that takes a little bit of scale.
Yes. I have two questions. First is, did you use a tool? Did you roll out this with a tool? I'm right here.
Oh, thanks.
And the second question is, did you put in place a team whose job it was to document the processes, train the staff, and roll it out?
Sure. We did not use a tool. We leveraged some tools. We decided at first we'd put the process in place, shake the process down, ensure that it was part of the culture, and then we would apply tools to it. We did leverage Remedy, which we had in place already for trouble management. We leveraged that for change management immediately because that was our biggest hole. And certainly we've continued to leverage it. We now have brought other tools in on top of it. But really, tools were not the driver. We had to have the process in place first. I could not get our executive team to buy in to putting a tool in place without the process being there. And looking back on it, it was definitely good advice and good counsel I got from them as well. In terms of having a person own it, I had my management team own it. The minute we started down this journey, I made it part of their goals for the year. We did take individual pieces and sort of divide ownership of components up. Software development lifecycle went to the director that owned the development organization. The service desk went to the director that owned both the service desk and computer operations. So we certainly used that sort of a model to divide it up, but I kept the responsibility within my management team. Yes.
What were the criteria you used to select Pink Elephant as a provider, and why did you choose them?
Frankly, they were the most visible company that we saw out there in the industry, and they were located in Canada, which was closer to Alaska. Yes, you had a question right up front? We did both. We did bring in a consulting firm to help us, especially lay out the initial set of processes. But whenever it came time for implementation, whenever it came time for training, whenever it came time for organizational change work that we needed to do internally, I actually took the consultants out of the mix then. I wanted them to see that our management team was really the driver and that we were using the consultants mainly to educate ourselves about best practices out in the industry. Any other questions? Yes. You bet. 30% of my staff left. And I only wanted about 20% of them to leave, to be honest. It's the story of I don't need these processes. I've been here for 8 years, and we've never had them before. And not correlating that to the fact that we're throttling the business because we don't have them. I went into it telling the COO, who I report to, that I anticipated that we would have potentially up to 50% of the staff leave. And it actually worked out well because then you bring in the right people with the right approach, the right attitude, and the skill sets you need for this model as opposed to completely trying to retrain, 30% of the staff. So, yes. Right. Certainly. Absolutely. Well, we actually were in a pretty similar situation. Although we're a public company now, our CEO was our original founder. And our management team was the original private ownership management team. So I walked into what is now a public company that was acting like a private company. Very entrepreneurial. Part of what we did was a significant amount of education about what the benefit was going to be by being slightly more process-driven. You know, I can't tell you the number of times I use that exact term, slightly more process-driven. If I had said we're going to a full-blown process-driven model, would have been very frustrating, I think, for everyone. They would have saw that as shutting down the entrepreneurial, fast-moving aspects of the business. And so we balance it. You know, there certainly are processes we have put in place that have been in place for a month or so, and I've gone back and said, you know, it's too restrictive for the way the business needs to operate. Let's go back and review it. Let's back off of some of the rigid structure that's in place and look at what a bare-bones process needs to be. I still think I would go about it trying to implement a broader process and backing off rather than putting a bare-bones process in and trying to grow it. So Anne's getting very near the stage, so I'm assuming my time is up. Thank you very much for your time. Enjoy the rest of the conference. Thank you. I'll see you.
Thank you, Jim. That was really great. And I will say again that we do have another ITIL session later this afternoon at 3:30. So any of you interested in the topic further can definitely come to that. So now, before we move into our next set of breakout sessions, we do have today's coaching winners to announce for the 45-minute coaching session. And today's coaching sessions and lunch are sponsored by VMware, so we thank them for that. So the first winner is Edwin McDonald from Diversitech, Michael Hankin from MultiQuip Construction, Joseph Edward from Diocese of London, Zelma Anderson from the U.S. Army, and Christopher Holbert from Launchpad Communications. So if all of you will just stop by the registration desk on your way to the breakouts to set up your time with the coach, that would be great. And so now we have two sets of breakout sessions, one before lunch and one after lunch, in salons A, B, and FG, right to the left and right of us. And then we'll be back here at 1:50 this afternoon to begin our afternoon sessions on next generation leadership, price optimization, and some other topics. So thank you, and we'll see you this afternoon.